And next we have Mapping the UK Elections of 2015, What Was Done and Did It Work? By Danny Dorling of Oxford University.
Thanks very much. Let's try it without the mic and see if that works. This is a little bit of a hobby horse of mine. I've been interested in how elections have been mapped for over 30 years. I became interested in this because of the amazing maps of the 1964-1966 elections in the Times newspaper, which I'm sure none of you will have seen, and I'm not going to show you because I'm restricting myself from not showing my very sad extensive collection of old electoral mapping. But the key thing about, if you're interested about the history of mapping elections, is that these were cartograms. And I suspect that the first one had taken over a year to produce by hand in a pre-computer age. From my point of view, electoral mapping kind of went downhill after that, because what happened is in 1970 they created new constituency boundaries, and that year's worth of work was completely useless anymore, and it couldn't be changed. But also the Labour Party lost the election in 1970, and suddenly you didn't need a map that showed population anymore because it was okay if it looked blue. And this, who actually wins elections, changes the way in which we vote. I put the abstract up, because I put the abstract up in before the election, just to show my continual amazing ability to get it wrong on what's likely to happen in the election. If you remember, in April of this year, all the speculation in the polls were that we were going to get some kind of incredibly complicated hung parliament. And people were trying to work out which three parties might join together and how long such a coalition would last and whether we'd have a second election in the autumn. Now it turns out we are actually having a second election. The second election, I don't get to vote in it, but it ends at 12 o'clock today. And arguably we wouldn't have had quite as interesting an election for the leader of the Labour Party as we have if it hadn't been for the fairly decisive results of the general election. So there's still lots of fun to come. The other reason, let's just show you a map. The other reason I've been interested in this kind of mapping is that I did my PhD in the late 1980s and produced a whole series of ideas about how you could do computer mapping of elections, none of which were taken up by the BBC or anybody else for decades. Some of them were silly. The electoral tetrahedron, which is like the swingometer but going into four dimensions, is a little bit complicated. But this kind of mapping is now normal. Finally, these kind of maps are normal. I'm going to restrict myself to just showing you the maps which were produced very quickly and the maps that appear in the media, which is free to access, which means the Telegraph and the Guardian and the Observer and the BBC. I have a feeling now that if you produce a map of a current event but only a select number of people can view it, it's much less worthwhile producing it than if you produce it for an outlet that which actually is available for free, although some people have to buy the newspaper for what's going to be produced. This is a lovely map, I think semi-done by hand, before the election, of what the result was predicted to be by the polls. I now live here. Somebody's got a sense of humour about what it is. It isn't rabbit shaped, but and this is a mixture of computer generated and done by hand. And you can see all those seats that the Liberals were supposed to win in the southwest of England at the time. The BBC did do some pretty stunning, from my point of view, graphics. They put people up on hillsides in Lancashire and they superimposed normal maps over them, but with constituencies coming in, flying in from above. I'm not confident enough to try to run you the video and it probably breaks the BBC copyright anyway, do that, but the presenter did a very good job of trying to guess where the animation was, because of course they couldn't see it. They also had a go of producing volume maps to try to show you that in fact all those red areas actually contain quite a lot of people. Lancashire isn't really a blue county. And they went into great detail about particular seats and marginals, which in hindsight was all completely and utterly wrong. When you look back at it, very convincing at the time, and they had no way of knowing, just as I had no way of knowing. But it is interesting to look back at how elections are reported before the event and actually think, you know, maybe there should be a greater degree of uncertainty in the reporting, and they shouldn't say things are quite as rock solid as they think they are. All this talk about so-and-so couldn't win an election, or this will happen, or that. We should learn from elections. Unusual things happen in elections. You can't actually predict them that well. James Jacob Gilchrist Berry, who was the most sure one to lose his seat, didn't lose his seat yet. I've now got a slight confession to make. That's why I make the confession. I do really kind of like these kind of maps. I do kind of like the BBC. I particularly like hexagonal cartograms. And I also happen to like Emily Maitlis. Now, if I've got it out. Now, I thought this was a very private thing until 2 days before the election. The BBC, for the one show, I think, the outside their reception, started building an hexagonal cartogram upon which Emily was going to dance on election night. And it was kind of all my Christmases coming. Anyway, you know, this is what I've been writing about in my PhD in the late 1980s, they should be doing. I didn't know Emily was going to exist at that point, but anyway, there she is. So this is a sort of new high point of graphics. The BBC's attitude to graphics is really interesting because they're very, very torn. On the one hand, for the last 20 years, they've had an incredible dumbing down to meet the audience. Don't make it too complicated. Don't even do something like the sphingometer now because people don't get it. You often see on the news on the BBC a bar graph with a single bar going up and down. So there's a dumbing down agenda. To be popular, at the same time, there's an agenda of let's be gee whiz, let's show off, let's see what we can do. And what happens is they invariably produce very innovative things, and then they're cut quite often by the production staff or the editor's team, and they're not used the next day or the next day because somebody has looked at the audience monitoring figures and seen that they drop off and decided that they can't do it. The one time that you have a lot of time on the television, on the radio, is between the exit poll at 1 minute past 10 and the first set of dozen series results. You've got about three and a half hours to fill then, where you really are only going to get a very nerdy audience. And I think the BBC could do a lot more in those 3.5 hours than put up tired old politicians who have to sit there lying to you, watching the tweets coming in on their BlackBerries that they've still got. I mean, maybe you're not as bad as me, you don't sit and actually watch it, but if I was going to make any plea in this little talk, it's just ask them to use that time innovatively to show off slightly complicated things about what we do know at the point when we have no idea of the election result apart from an exit poll. And one last thing to say about exit polls. In the last couple of elections, they've been remarkably accurate. There's no reason for them having to be that accurate. They've been a bit lucky as well. They can go wrong. People don't have to systematically tell the truth to somebody when they come out of a polling booth and somebody asks them how they vote. There's a great danger when you happen to get within 1 or 2% of the result of thinking that you've done very well, whereas in fact, it's very hard to get 10% out. Just by chance, sometimes you're going to hit spot on. And you saw that kind of danger and the result of it with how the polls were systematically wrong this time, apart from the exit poll. But it doesn't mean the exit poll's brilliant. Okay, the very first people, I think, to get the result out on the map were the Telegraph. It was done quickly, it was done crudely. Oxford East is suddenly neighbouring London. So it's not one of the best cartographs produced, but it was out and it was there, and it was not a map. Cartograms have begun to sweep the board as far as elections are mapped, maybe because the result was seen as close. Now, if you look at the actual result, which is the map nearer me, and the predictions based on the polls, you'll see they're not actually that different. 90% of constituencies, you know, bar a minor miracle, or the kind of thing that happened in 1945, you really know for 90% of constituencies where they're going to go. So it's all about 10% of constituencies. So although this was a very surprising result and very unlikely predictions, you have to look very carefully to see the difference between the predictions and what we got. The Observer, I thought, were a bit garish. They were using the same cartoon, of course, as The Guardian. They are kind of joined up, The Observer and The Guardian. They're in the same building. So quite why they changed the colours to make them a bit brighter, I wasn't sure. But it was a better job than The Telegraph, but it came out a little bit later. Hypothesis, my collaborator Ben Hennig, had been taken away for a holiday somewhere with no internet connection and no electricity. Or somebody to get away from me, I think. But managed, still in Lancashire, to draw some maps of the election. So I'm going to show you all those in a minute. And coming to the end of what the media did, The Guardian did include some cartograms of change and change in vote shares. Not particularly successful, but at least they were beginning to try and look at something more complicated, because what really matters in an election is how it differs from the election before. And it isn't just the seats that change hands, it's is something moving under the surface? Are you beginning to see a change in the direction of trend over time? That's the kind of thing that's most interesting about an election. There's Ben again. He really was mapping over London so that we could get some of the maps out. And the method is one that was designed by Mark Newman and Glasswood from the US, and it's this kind of stretchy way of doing cartograms. So here's your three ways: a normal map, which is always blue and very yellow now. I haven't said much about Scotland, I probably should in a minute. The hexagonal one, which makes every constituency the same shape, so in a way it's easier to compare. And then the kind of stringy one, which is topologically correct. Some people object to, because often when they live in rural areas that have been stretched out, tend to object to it. But that final map does allow you to zoom in, and then you can put roads on it, you know, the motorway network would all join up, and so on. Maybe in 10 years' time, that's the kind of map Emily, or a young man, perhaps, if we move forward even further, could be dancing on. So we'll see. This is what the US maps look like. If you have got to remember, red and blue is the other way around in the US, just to be different, how things work politically. But it's kind of, it's beginning to look a bit medical. Yeah, the map's beginning to look slightly, I mean, cancerous might be the wrong word, but it's, and that's if you turn it to voting shares. You can tell Mark's a physicist, not a cartographer, so it's just the mixing of the red and the blue of the Democrats and the Republicans get you the purple in the middle. And the US really is a country where the cities are Democrats, the rural areas are Republican. It is very, very divided. Real hatred between people in different sides of politics in the US now, and a very divided geography. We are beginning to look more and more like the US in terms of our voting and our political differences between places. This is the map of who came second, which is interesting because this is the map where you can actually see UKIP doing well on. UKIP only won one seat because of the normal number of votes. We've gone and given them their own purple, which means they recede into the background visually, just as the Conservatives recede into the background slightly less of the blue. But there they are. There are all the Liberals who disappeared. Quite a lot of them still came second. And it's that kind of stringy US shape that we can again. This, I think, is the map that really chose it for me. It's using a terrible rainbow colour scheme, one I happen to like because I'm a child of the 60s and I'm Tonka toys with these colours. It's just showing you just share the Conservative vote. Conservative vote hitting, I think, 40% or more in the very dark areas. Not there, disappearing in the dark red areas. Gone from Scotland long ago, gone from Liverpool. And it's a very, very divided map. I should mention turnout. We just put turnout there, but I'm going to run out of time. Of course, turnout is remarkably low, especially for a narrow election. The Liberal Party are more than decimated. Decimated means losing one in 10 of your MPs. So they were much more than decimated. If we look at where the Liberals are now in terms of the vote, they're really falling back into their very old pockets of support. And compare them to UKIP, which is massive. I mean, these two parties, I think, it's tricky to say which is the third party in terms of votes. The third party in terms of seats, of course, is the SNP. And the last time we had a third party winning as many seats as the SNP won was 1918, and it was Sinn Féin. And what happened after that was part of the UK split off. So it's a pretty unprecedented election in all that way. Plaid Cymru, poor things, are hardly there but hanging on. Haven't had a bonus from the SNP, and the SNP have done something quite amazing in Scotland. Wouldn't matter for Labour. Labour could have won all those seats and they couldn't afford the government either. Okay, the divisions are falling apart. You're getting Labour areas becoming more Labour, Conservative areas are becoming more Conservative. The map isn't probably the best way to show this. It's going to be a graph that's the best way to show it. The map, the far distance for me, is the poverty rates. We've got some brilliant poverty data now. This is actually data on the proportion of children living in families in receipt of benefits. So it's not an estimate anymore. It's just a direct count of children who are deemed by government to be poor divided by the number of children. And if you look at the differences between the blues and the reds, you're looking at the political map. With a colleague from Cambridge just before the election for Prospect magazine, we took all the parliamentary constituencies and we ranked them precisely by poverty. And the poverty data is so good you can actually say you are constituency 321, you are constituency 330. And what we did then is we paired them. We took the constituency with the lowest rate of poverty and the highest rate of poverty in the country, and we suggested that the MPs might think of doing a house swap for a week just to see what it was like in an area with different constituencies. Not a single member of parliament has taken up our offer since the election. But when you've got a very divided country, MPs endlessly tell you about their constituents, by which they actually mean the people who turn up on the Friday night who aren't representative. But Conservative MPs have very, very few poor constituents now. They're not just not going to meet them. And Labour MPs have very few wealthy constituents now. Getting to the end, there's the electoral tetrahedron. If any of you were interested in it, if you have four parties and you're trying to place them, you need to use that. Here's the race that is ending at 12 o'clock today. I don't think anybody will take the votes from the various constituencies of members and actually show where they went on that, but you never know. And I've got to end with a graph because the graph is remarkable, and maybe I need to find a better way to get the maps to show it. This graph is showing you the segregation index of Conservative votes from 1918 onwards. It's very segregated in 1918. Protestant Unionist areas voted Conservative in Glasgow and in Liverpool. Other areas wouldn't vote Conservative at all. Became less and less segregated. Forget who wins or loses, it's the mix. So that by the 1960s, in almost every constituency in the country, there were Conservative voters and Labour voters and so on. And we were a more mixed society. There was a blip in 1974, a very important blip, but then from 1979 onwards, the Conservative voters become more and more segregated, so that in 2010, the biggest rise in the Conservative vote was in areas that already had Conservative MPs. This was devastating for them, which is why the coalition was formed, because they couldn't get enough MPs. This is why I said there's going to be a hung parliament, because their vote was becoming more segregated. I couldn't see how they could do better. In the event, the segregation index has gone up again. And not just gone up, it's gone up by more than three elections worth of rise. But they won. And they won because of the most miraculous distribution of votes. Only one in four people voted Conservative who had a right to vote. But in just the right places, despite all the wasted votes in Surrey, for them to win. So it's an exciting election. It's completely wrong, I think, to suggest that it's possible to predict anything about 2020, given what's happened and how much can change. But one thing we can do is we can ask the media outlets, and particularly the TV outlets, to play around more with graphics and to play around more with things that we're certain about that have happened, and just wait till you get the actual results before speculating as much, because looking back, there was so much wasted hot air talked about it that turned out not to be useful, but at the time seemed to be ever so well informed. Thank you very much.
Thanks for a very visually stimulating presentation, Danny. You welcome questions? Yes?
I know this isn't particularly cartographic, but before 2020 election, we'll be having an EU referendum. So will UKIP disappear, or will it, depending on which way the vote goes, come into its own year third?
It should do well out of an EU referendum. UKIP traditionally does well in the EU elections. More people vote UKIP. I mean, the rise of UKIP is quite interesting because, in a way, most normal big European countries have a far right party, and we've kind of finally become properly European with the rise of UKIP. But there's no sign of UKIP going away, and that isn't what happens in France, you know, and it isn't what happens in Spain and so on. I think UKIP are definitely here to stay. There's a danger about leadership. As soon as you go to the edges of politics, and you saw this with the National Front and the BNP, they always collapse when the leader turns out to be an idiot. They rely on single individuals, and maybe a problem on the other side of politics, we're going to see. Whereas in the middle of politics, leaders are less important because they tend to be a bit bland, because they have to say boring middle of the road things because of what they're presenting. So it's going to be fun watching the UKIP leadership. So it's not a very happy leadership.
Before 2020, there's going to be boundary change.
Yeah.
And despite what's said, boundary change is always politically inspired.
Yeah.
Have you done anything yet to try and map and understand the likely impact of boundary change? Because it seems to me that it could be really dramatic.
We looked at boundary changes in the past. You know, when in the event they could get you 11 or 12 MPs, in hindsight, the ones that happened in the past. I mean, we're in a very strange position. The Conservatives did not expect to win. So they expected not to be able to implement the boundary changes because the Liberals would have stopped them doing it. They're now committed to do it, but they haven't brought the legislation forward. And their real problem is that although it is in the interest of their party, for the individual MPs who have to vote for it, they're voting themselves out of a safe job. Because when you get the boundary changes, you've got to reselect the MPs. The MPs are currently safely sitting there. It's very hard for their local parties to reselect them. So there are quite a lot of, you know, not particularly hard-working backwoodsmen sitting there in nice rural home county seats who are supposed to be voting for this. But for their personal interest, they don't want to. I think they'll push it through and get it. My personal feeling is that the shifts in voting and beliefs are so big, and the rise in UKIP, other changes, what happened in Scotland, that changes in people's attitudes are going to matter more than boundary changes, and particularly the very high proportion of young people who didn't vote. If the young decide even a 10% rise in voting amongst people under 30, that has a huge impact. They're in the right places to do it, and that probably matters more than boundary changes. The only age group which was majority Conservative voting were the over 65s, it's the most remarkable election result, given that every other age group in the country didn't support the party who actually formed a government, but they also didn't tend to go out to vote.
Any other questions? One time for one more, if there is one. Otherwise, another round of applause. Thank you again.